Hi, I'm Chris Wigley, CEO of Genomics England. I've spent my career at the intersection of technology, ethics, and human stories. Now, I lead the amazing team here at Genomics England. We're trying to bring the benefits of genomic medicine to everyone, and that involves accelerating genomic research and also working with the NHS to bring genomics into the heart of healthcare. Genomics is a word that can trigger really strong responses, hope, fear, anger, and there's a lot of information out there, but it's not all accessible to non-experts. And there are some myths out there. So we want to talk more about this word, the G word, genomics. That's what this podcast is about. Welcome to the G word. It's my huge pleasure today to be joined on the podcast by John James, who's the CEO of the Sickle Cell Society, and who before that was in the NHS for 33 years and held various positions as the chief exec of different trusts and parts of the NHS, and was also the first Black African Caribbean chief exec in the NHS. John received an OBE in 2018 for his services to sickle cell and health, and it's a huge honour for us to have him on the show. John, welcome to the pod.
Thank you very much, Chris, and I'm delighted to be with you.
Now, let's start right at the beginning, if we can. I'd love to understand, how did you first get into healthcare? What was the motivation or inspiration?
Well, the inspiration, I guess, was my parents. So I'm, a sort of second generation Windrush person. And my uncle, my mother's brother, tried to get into medical school in the UK. Didn't happen, so he got into Howard University, which is very much a sort of Black university medical school, and went on to be an excellent doctor, surgeon in his career. So growing up, my mother was saying, look at Uncle Rupert, you know, this is what you have to aspire to, young man, you know, in this world. So there was that element of my parents. But also my mother was a nurse in the health service, and so there was that connection. Now, clearly, I wasn't bright enough to be a doctor, so I thought management would be a good route to get in, and I became a management trainee. So man and boy started out in the health service as a management trainee. And I have to say I've been, you know, very privileged in my career to be part of, you know, one of the world's greatest systems, and it's really difficult to see it currently under the strain that it is because of the pandemic that we're all suffering from.
Absolutely. Well, I mean, if I can tease you slightly, then the rest of your career would suggest that you were clearly not particularly smart.
Absolutely.
And so you had a long and a very successful career in the NHS. It's noteworthy you mentioned about your uncle having trained in an exclusively Black organisation. But over the 33 years that you were in the NHS, did you see attitudes to race change, and did that affect your own personal journey?
It affected my journey very much so. I guess when I was a senior leader in the NHS, so that's not necessarily about being chief executive, whether I was a director or on the board, during those times, I was part of something called the less than 1% club, which suggested that, you know, given the size of the NHS, to have less than 1% of its leaders from a Black or minority ethnic background was pretty appalling. And if you roll forward to 2020, it's evident that improvements have been made in terms of diversity within the NHS. But I would question whether it's transformational. So, you know, give credit where credit due. Improvement is being made, but it's slow, and there is still resistance to what I would call transformational change. So back in the day, if you're on a board and you had a non-executive director from a Black and minority, well, that's it. We've done it. We've ticked that box. We don't, you know, depending on the area that you're in, that mentality was, it did feel rather tick box. And also public organisations are good at having the diversity fig leaf. So their publications would feature black and brown people and disabled people and women, but actually their application of diversity within their organisations left a lot to be desired, really.
And you're clearly now an inspiring role model for younger people from different ethnic backgrounds. Do you think, what can we do to tell more of those stories or encourage more people into healthcare?
Well, I think role models is a very important thing, and that's certainly one aspect of encouraging the young people to have a career in the NHS. The other interesting thing is that the NHS uniquely has a range of potential careers. So it's not just management. There's medicine, there's nursing, there's professions allied to medicine. So there's a whole range of careers. And I think we don't do enough to encourage across that broad spectrum. And I also think that how people are treated, because if you look at NHS staff surveys over the years, the people who feel discriminated, bullied, tended to be the black and brown staff and so forth. So there is something about the way in which people are treated, developed and supported that can be a factor. Because if you take nursing, my mother was a nurse, and there have been great strides, some great, you know, young nurse leaders out there at all different levels. But many young people will have known some of their parents working in the service having a pretty hard time and not recognised for the work that they do. So people have long memories. So we need to, or the service needs to, demonstrate how it's changing, but changing in a positive way that is welcoming. Because at the very, very top, the NHS is still not as diverse as it should be in 2020, or 2021 we're in, actually.
Right, for sure. And so attitudes changed over the course of your career. Today, of course, we're talking about genomics. When you started in the NHS, genomics, I guess, was more of a concept. And then, you know, late 90s, 2000, we have the Human Genome Project. Now, in 2021, we're just on the verge of launching whole genome sequence diagnostics as part of mainstream medical care. That's quite a journey that genomics has been on. In your time in the NHS, was the discussion as the chief exec of a trust, or being on the board of a part of the NHS, of those kind of topics, or did it feel at that time like it was still very far away?
That's a very good question, Chris. If I'm honest, from my experience, it felt very far away. And the gist of the challenges that leaders were dealing with at that time was all about target-driven things that needed to be achieved, whether that was waiting lists, whether that was managing the money well, because it's a finite pot. So it was very much about success being measured on a range of targets. And some of those targets were health outcome related. So it wasn't all process targets. But it was very much driven in that culture. And the notion of genomics would be parked in a sort of academic research and development area until something came to fruition.
Absolutely. And we think a lot, especially at Genomics England, around how we communicate with the public and with patients around genomics and so on. But I guess there's also a really huge question about how do we communicate with and listen to and help bring along a whole range of healthcare professionals as well. And as a, you know, experienced leader in the health service, what do you think the right kind of channels or ways of engaging those communities of healthcare professionals can be as you know, over the coming years?
Let me start by saying the work that Genomics England is doing, and the sequencing and the science of all of that is really exciting. And there seems to be, from my perspective, a gap in translating that excitement, that scientific advancement and excitement, to clinicians who are under the cosh at the moment. So most clinicians, wherever they are, you know, are having to deal with rising mortality because of the pandemic. But that aside, in normal times, engaging them in something as exciting as this genomic sequencing and science isn't happening. So I think there's more work to do, both with healthcare professionals and organisations such as ourselves, a charity, the Sickle Cell Society. And why I say that, Chris, is that sickle cell as a genetic condition should be one of the leading development areas in the genomic space. But I don't think it is. And there are various reasons why that is. But so I think, and it's probably me putting a challenge to you without articulating all the answers to that, but I think there is a challenge when there's a degree of stability with the service and, you know, the country, to make some rapid improvement on engaging healthcare professionals, charities such as ourselves, and indeed people who live with rare disease. And particularly, and I make no apology for saying so, particularly black and brown people as part of that. So I think that's the challenge I see if I was sitting where you were sitting.
Well, challenge accepted. And we could book in another podcast in a year's time to see if we've made some progress. You can hold us to account. So you mentioned just now that sickle cell anemia is a genetic disease. Tell us a little bit more about that, because sickle cell has a particular place, I guess, in the history of understanding the genetics of different healthcare conditions and starting to be able to understand and diagnose and treat them. Just give us a little bit of a 101 or a masterclass.
Sure. Well, I want to start about, as you quite rightly say, sickle cell has been around for a very long time, well over 100 years in terms of being known medically. And in fact, Nobel Prizes have been given for, you know, working out the genomes in the world of sickle cell. So here we have a condition that's been known about medically for years and years. There have been eminent people who have received Nobel Prizes for, you know, their analysis and understanding of the makeup of the gene and the genetic makeup of this. And thirdly, it affects a particularly cohort of people, not exclusively, because there are clearly white individuals who have sickle cell or are carriers of the sickle cell gene, but predominantly it is people whose heritage is from Africa, the Caribbean, Latin America, Northern Europe, and so forth. So I'm saying that because if you roll forward and think, for all those years, what advancements, what scientific innovation has happened for sickle cell? The answer, Chris, is barely nothing. So here, the point that I'm making is that the people who live with this condition have been underserved. So in 2021, there is only one licensed treatment in the UK for sickle cell. That's hydroxyurea, which is a treatment that wasn't even invented for sickle cell. It's a chemotherapy drug that has benefits. So from many people's perspective who are in the space of sickle cell, they'll tell you why. Well, they'll ask the question, why has there been no scientific development for sickle cell over these decades? And I think that that has something to do with race, it has something to do with discrimination, and those are factors that people, you know, may find challenging when, you know, I say this, but this is an underserved population. Having taken into account that it is possibly this country's biggest genetic blood condition, I'll give you an analogy, and the analogy is not to be critical of anyone who lives with cystic fibrosis, or the charity of the Cystic Fibrosis Society. But cystic fibrosis affects, by and large, a different cohort of patients. Again, not exclusively, but by and large, a different cohort of patients. They have, and credit to them, I'm not knocking them, they have a wealthy charity that invests lots of money in research and development. And of course, there's a much wider choice of drugs or disease-modifying treatments for cystic fibrosis when compared to sickle cell. So I'm just comparing the genetic conditions here. And therefore, when you do those comparisons, you have to ask, well, why is that? And I remember a quote, and then I'll stop. I remember somebody saying to me, oh, well, John, sickle cell only affects black people, so I really don't support the organization because it's not something that's going to affect me or my family. So I'm making the distinction between a condition that, as I say, you know, academics have won Nobel Prizes, but actually the translation of improvement science in this area is woeful, is absolutely woeful.
And John, what would you like to see in this field in the coming years?
Well, let's stick with genomics and the exciting development of the 100,000 genomes projects and sequencing and so forth. Let's stick with that. That feels to me that this should be an area that is making rapid progress in trying to establish greater benefit for people who live with this condition and other rare diseases. And we can't, I don't think we're having that conversation, Chris. So that's what I want to see as far as genomics is concerned, that there is a active conversation about how this new and exciting science can make a transformational benefit to people who live with sickle cell. And alongside that, I would like to see more choice of disease-modifying treatments available for people with sickle cell, just as there is for other rare conditions, or not everyone, but the majority of other rare conditions.
Got it. And let me play back my understanding of where we're at. And I'm not an expert here, so apologies if I get some of this wrong. But when I think about the types of scientific research that are happening in the various communities or kind of partnerships that Genomics England is involved in, often they're looking at trying to understand the impact of glitches or variants in an individual's genome that may be associated with a disease. So as far as I understand, with sickle cell, to the point about Nobel Prizes, that's now pretty well understood. If you have this variant in the genome, you will have the condition sickle cell. It's also, as far as I understand, quite clear to diagnose. So the research agenda, therefore, I guess, that you would like to see is much more around what can be done to either cure this. And I'm guessing with like emerging technologies like CRISPR and so on, question mark, is there a sort of gene editing or gene therapy approach out there, or to understand more about what can be done to ameliorate the effects of having the condition. Is that right?
Yes, that's a good analysis. So when I say benefit, I'm talking about the work that's taken place on gene editing and CRISPR indeed. Curative or disease modifying. I mean, I think patients would welcome either one at this point, because there isn't anything beyond hydroxyurea. So yes, your analysis is correct. I'd like to see, you know, one of the aims, and you can correct me if I'm wrong because I'm not a student of Genomics England, but you know, one of the aims of Genomics England is to bring benefit to patients. And it seems to me, given what is known about sickle cell, that this should be not an easy win, but it should be amongst the low-hanging fruit within the scientific development.
Absolutely. The intent is very much to bring benefit to patients in really close partnership with the NHS. What we don't have in-house is research teams working on particular, like the development of therapeutics or whatever. But what we do absolutely have is a series of what we call clinical interpretation partnerships, working with researchers in different areas. And it's back to your earlier point about throwing down the challenge. I think there are some conversations that we can and should have with the various groups around, you know, bringing this to the forefront. The challenges that you outlined speak to the inequalities that persist in healthcare, particularly when we think about access to advanced therapies or treatments or diagnoses based on emerging technologies like genomics and others. How can we think about structurally addressing some of those inequalities over the coming years?
I think in part it goes back to understanding that those inequalities exist. So let me frame it by saying that, and you referred to the recent data from ONS in terms of the relationship between income and COVID. There's also been work done by Public Health England, the London School of Tropical Medicine, and so forth, which shows the impact of COVID on the black and minority ethnic population. One of the things that surprised people like me during the last 10 months of how people seem surprised that those inequalities exist, and I would argue some of us have known they've been there, and that includes people within the health service. So at the outset, Chris, you have to acknowledge that those inequalities exist and not put them to one side, and to do something about them. And I think for some black people, the evidence of the commitment to do anything about those things is still, the jury's still out on that. So I think that we should be developing plans to address those at a system level within the NHS where we can do that, whether that's for rare disease or general services. And that requires commitment and it requires leadership. And I guess the point that I'm making is that I don't always see the leadership or people who speak up for within the service. We need to get on top of this. That might be difficult now because of where we are. But I think the risk of not doing that is continuation of communities being underserved and thus having greater mortality than they should. And also, I think the other factor is this weariness is the only word I can find amongst our communities of nothing's going to be done. So we know, for example, there's lots of anti-vaccination rhetoric and lies out there, and a lot of that is within the BAME community as well. So if they're seeing that things are not progressing, or again, people have long memories. So think of Tuskegee in the United States. You know, as a little boy growing up, I learnt about Tuskegee. You know, so there's fear and anxiety about what these things might mean for the black community. So I think there's, you know, it's a very long-winded answer, but I think it's leadership and commitment to have discrete plans that people are committed to make change over a period of time.
Yeah. You rightly talk about people, communities having long memories about a justifiable hesitancy or suspicion, maybe even, about some of these approaches. The vaccine question is obviously a very topical one as we're speaking this week. Nadeem Zahawi was talking about it on the radio, I think just yesterday or the morning before, saying if we end up in a situation where 80% of the population have vaccine and 20 don't, you know, that's probably fine. But if those 20 are disproportionately people from minority ethnic groups, that's not fine. You know, we need to do something about that. When we think about engaging with the black community, the South Asian community, other communities in the UK, You've mentioned things like misinformation going around on social media. How can we do that in a productive way that's not patronizing, that's constructive, and a sort of adult to adult conversation with those communities?
I think that large organizations like the NHS need to engage in bite-sized chunks. By that, I mean that they should be working with organizations such as ourselves, charities, organizations like us, churches, other enterprises, and very much do it on a level that is connected with that community. I think large organizations sometimes, you know, send out messages that don't always reach where they are intended, and there's not that rich dialogue of conversation that takes place. So I think it's about working with organizations and working with organizations in a way that is transparent and evidence-based, and also by using, we talked earlier about this, Chris, we talked about, you know, my time in the NHS and the importance of role models, and using role models within that process of local discussions. And I think that's the way forward. The kind of style a lot of the time, so I listened to some of what Nazim Zahawi had to say. A lot of the time you have, dare I say, the great and the good and the, you know, highly intelligent coming up with plans, but they haven't really engaged at the right level with the communities to whom those plans are designed for. So I think that works better, and I think there's good evidence to say that that works a lot better.
And the legendary Floella Benjamin is an ambassador, or
she's a patron. She's one of our patrons, one of our many patrons, and we love Floella. She does a lot of work for us as a charity, and we're very proud to have her as one of our patrons.
Can you see the benefit of that, and how do you think we can encourage more people like Floella to play that kind of role model role, so to speak?
I think we can encourage, you know, Floella, you know, does so much, but there are other trustees who would be willing and able to do the same. Some of them have other, you know, business and career commitments, which means that sometimes it's a challenge to do all of that, but their willingness is there. I also think, Chris, that it's those celebrities, if we can call them that, but it's ordinary people as well. And if we can use those in the sort of concept of role modelling at a local level, that helps, because they're ordinary people who are either respected or understood and are not seen to be having any particular affiliations, whether that's political or anything else. So I think it's a combination of those things at a local level.
For sure. I think some of the respected members of communities are often in unexpected places, right? I mean, we talk a lot about faith leaders and so on, but often teachers or pharmacists or the person running the kids' football club or whatever can be a fantastic role model in a community. I guess for someone like a government minister or the leadership of the NHS, or indeed Genomics England, how do you think we can best kind of reach through that capillary network to engage with that community of local leaders?
Okay, well, I think there is a way you can do that, and it's a way that I've suggested to another large, very large public sector organisation. And some of that is about commissioning specific pieces of work. You might not have the staff who have the capacity, capability to do that work, but you can commission groups to do that work for you who are based in the community. That's one model, or you can create it yourself with the right people. But certainly we have experience, and I don't really want to name them, but we have experience where a large organization was, you know, trying to increase a number of black people involved in something, and were struggling. And we made suggestions where they're now commissioning things, and there's still a long way to go, but there are green shoots of spring, so to speak.
Fantastic. Well, we could all do with some green shoots of spring at the moment, I think, both literally and metaphorically. If we start to get more of this right as a community, as a society, what would you like to see happening in a few years' time, and what would the signs be that this was working?
The signs that it would be working would involve a clearer acceptance from patients with sickle cell that they understand the roadmap of genomes and how, whether it's through partners or whatever, how that is going to bring potential benefit to their lives. That certainly, to me, would be evidence of success. Another form of evidence would be effective engagement with those communities. The way in which you do that, we talked about that a moment ago, but effective engagement with those communities to enable you to have collated real information about what it means, which should inform how you maneuver your strategy, so that actually what's happening is that in terms of that second example, you're engaging with people in the way that we described before, and that input, whether favorable, impartial, or whatever you get out of it, informs how you move forward as an organization with the strategic agenda for expanding sequencing or whatever. So that would be a second form of evidence. And a third form in the sickle cell and rare disease space is that there is generally a higher profile of what you're doing. And again, this is no criticism of you, Chris, or your organisation, but not everybody knows what's happening. And so what I mean by that is there's more publicity, there's more understanding. It's out there rather than seen as, oh, gosh, that's the, you know, clever academics working on this big research and development project. So that would be a form of evidence that you're seeping into the knowledge and understanding of a wider public.
For sure. And those human stories, I guess, as you say, are really a marker of whether something is meaningful or not. Is it actually impacting someone's life? That's a really positive and I think pragmatic view of the future that is exciting to work towards. I'll try and book you in for another podcast next year, and we can see how far we've got.
Yeah, no, it's a pleasure, you know, talking about these things, because I genuinely believe that the genomic space is an exciting one. I think whilst Genomics England won't be producing any disease modifying treatments or whatever, it's informing with its industry partners or NHS partners what can happen. So I think the sickle cell area is an area in the context of diversity that you should be getting involved in. And the result of that is that it should help you rather than hinder you.
John James, thank you so much for your time today. Look forward to speaking again soon and working together on these issues.
Thank you very much, Chris, and good luck. Thank you very much. Stay safe.
Well, that's all for this episode. Thanks for listening to this discussion about the G word and for joining us on this journey to highlight and debate the implications of genomics as it comes to the mainstream of healthcare and society. Remember to subscribe to the G word on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen. If you have views on these topics, if you have a suggestion for someone we should interview, then do write to us at podcast@genomicsengland.co.uk. And do remember, if you've enjoyed listening, that giving us a 5-star review really helps other people find out about the series, and appreciate it very much. See you on the next episode of The G Word.